The second case scheduled for oral argument this morning is All American Ice versus American Arena. Welcome to the Court of Appeals, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You will notice the courtroom looks a little bit different. We have Judge Frisch appearing remotely, but is working just fine. And I would just encourage you, as you are presenting an argument, to look at the screen from time to time, as Judge Frisch will be participating fully in the argument this morning. Also, I know you are both familiar with our policies and procedures, and just remind you that you will each have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It is important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. And I see two lawyers at the respondents' tables. I assume just one of you is presenting the argument.
Yeah, Tim Matson for the respondent, and Michael Berg, a lawyer in our firm.
All right, joining you. So with that, counsel for appellant, I know you guys are still getting ready, but if you are ready, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, Kevin Hickey, Bassford Remley, on behalf of Appellant American Arena. Two words. That's what this appeal is all about. Whether respondent can legally protect and prevent my client and others in the industry from using two non-distinct descriptive words, American Arena, based on its state registration for All American Arena products. This case is also about the fundamental principle in trademark law that a mark must be distinctive to be legally protectable. Non-distinct, generic, or descriptive marks are not protectable as a matter of law, regardless of state registration, as the Minnesota Supreme Court made clear in the imported auto parts case.
Did your client ever make that argument in the district court? By way, for example, of a summary judgment or JMOL?
There was the defense of descriptiveness, which is part of legal protectability, as I just mentioned. A descriptive mark is not legally protectable. And there was an attempt to have a jury instruction on descriptive, on the descriptive standard. There was an attempt to admit evidence of descriptiveness, primarily the USPTO's determination that American Arena was descriptive and not legally protectable. And then on the special verdict discussion in the transcript, there's also some discussion of that. And then, of course, post-trial, when we got the case, that was the focus of our post-trial motions.
I understand the post-trial motion all raised that, but as far as the discussions of preliminary jury instructions, the proposed jury instructions, the special verdict form. When you talked about descriptiveness, wasn't that just dealing with the descriptiveness of your client's mark as a defense to trademark infringement? Isn't that fair to say?
Your Honor, that's fair to say, but those are the words that are at issue in this case. They're not claiming, we don't use All American, we don't use products. The two words that they're trying to protect our American Arena.
But Mr. Hickey, I'm reading your brief. I thought it was pretty clear. Your claim is that All American Product Arena or some part of that is a descriptive, not distinctive mark. That's your argument, right? That's what you want us to get to, even though you did not object to that at trial. Okay.
Your Honor, that mark is descriptive as well. You can't really separate the two marks, or the whole argument, the whole case is based on that the marks are so similar. Both marks are descriptive, but the two words that they're attempting to protect, Your Honor, are American Arena. Those are descriptive, as is All American Arena products. Frankly, it's probably more descriptive, because if you ask someone, what does All American Arena products sell? Arena products.
I think one of the things that really caught my attention, and then I will let you get to some of your argument, I apologize, but was the preliminary instruction about trademark registration. Therefore, when an owner brings an action for infringement, the owner may rely solely on the registration certificate to prove that the owner has the right to exclude others. That language, which counsel for your client at the time did not object to. So that,
Your
that
Honor,
troubles me. How do we get around that to address the legal issue that you raise on
Well, the plaintiff may rely on that, but it doesn't mean that the defendant doesn't get to raise any defenses. And the defendant attempted to raise the defense of descriptiveness, which is a clear and obvious defense to a mark like this, and was shut down at every turn, shut down on a jury instruction, shut down on evidence at trial, shut down in the special verdict form, and then it was rejected post-trial on our motion as well. It can be decided as a matter of law. That's exactly what the Supreme Court did in the imported auto parts case. In that case, there was also a state registration, which would support that language that you just read, that you can rely on a state registration. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said, no, despite a state registration, if it's descriptive, it's not.
Wasn't that decided summary judgment, though? I'm sure you know that better than I do that.
No, it was decided on summary judgment, but what the Supreme Court did, at summary judgment, they did not strike the state registration. They just found that the Supreme Court said the state registration is invalid because this mark is a generic descriptive mark, imported auto parts, and so it's something that shouldn't have been registered to begin with. So the court did hold as a matter of law that this state registration was not valid. And that's what we're claiming as well in this case, Your Honor. I do want to focus, and it looks like we have already, on the what I think is the threshold legal issue of legal protectability, because number one, it disposes of the entire case. As you can see from the briefing, there are what we believe are numerous errors at the trial court. And this is a threshold legal issue that would not require the court to decide those remaining issues. Number two, there's controlling Minnesota Supreme Court authority on this. This case is on all fours with imported auto parts. You've got a geographic term, American in one case, imported in the other, describing the products that are used, auto parts in one, arena products in the other. And the Minnesota Supreme Court held that is descriptive and generic, and it's non-distinct as a matter of law. And we don't care that you have a state registration. We're not going to enforce that, because to do that would allow you to monopolize descriptive words that other people in the industry can fairly use to describe their products.
How do you respond to the argument? I mean, if it was just American, just American arena products, that would be one thing, but we have all American, which seems to connote a quality of the company or the services it provides.
Your Honor, I agree. That's a distinguishing factor between the two marks. We don't use all hyphen American, and we don't use products. And I think that's a distinguishing factor. But it's still tacking on a general generic term like all American or premier or quality, words like that, onto a descriptive term doesn't change the fact that it's still descriptive. That's imported. It's something that, there's a number of cases that we cited where simply tacking on a generic term like that does not make it suggestive. I think the main problem here, Your Honor, at the trial court was that the court never had the jury consider the spectrum of protectability here, which is generic marks are never protectable, descriptive marks are not protectable unless they're secondary meaning, and there's no dispute there was none here. Suggestive marks are protectable, arbitrary and fanciful are protectable as well.
But how can we fault the district court for not doing so when you didn't ask for those instructions?
Well, the trial counsel did ask for descriptiveness. That's what his position was on what this mark is. That's our position, is that the mark is descriptive.
That was talking about descriptiveness of your client's mark, right?
Yeah. But that's what's being challenged, Your Honor. We don't use all American. I'm sorry. We're not using all American. The words that the injunction stops us from using American arena. The entire case is based on stopping us from using American arena. So those are the words that are at issue in this case. Their mark, if you want to look
at it. But counsel, the question isn't whether your mark is protectable. Question is whether plaintiff's mark was, or the defendant's mark was protectable, or the plaintiff's mark was protectable, excuse me, whether All American is protectable. And that issue was not raised.
Well, the issue was raised, Your Honor, that what they're trying to protect is the two words within their four-word mark, All American Arena Products. They're attempting to protect American Arena. They can't protect products because we don't use it. They can't protect All hyphen American because we don't use it. What they're trying to protect are the two words American Arena, because they're trying to prevent us from using those two words. And those two words, the USPTO has found, are descriptive, and it certainly would fall within the holding of the imported auto parts as descriptive. But even if you look at their mark as a whole, that's descriptive as well. It's not suggestive, Your Honor. That's where I think the trial court for the first time found that the mark All American was suggestive post-trial. Because what happened here is at trial, the court wouldn't allow anything regarding descriptiveness, which is what these marks are. And so post-trial, we said this mark was descriptive as a matter of law, and there was no evidence of secondary meaning, so the court should reverse. The court avoided that result because there was no dispute that descriptiveness was not allowed before the jury. Secondary meaning was not allowed before the jury. The court found for the first time post-trial that this mark was suggestive. And that's the hook on which the trial court found that the mark is inherently distinctive and protectable as a matter of law. It found that it was suggestive. This, Your Honors, is not a suggestive mark, and it's not even close to being a suggestive mark. A suggestive mark, as defined under the law, is one that, quote, requires some measure of imagination to reach a conclusion regarding the nature of the product. That's from the Duluth News case. It takes no imagination whatsoever to figure out that All American Arena Products sells arena product.
I could move to another issue, because I did have a question.
Okay,
certainly. But I don't want to, I think you have something to wrap up there.
No, I just think that it's not suggestive as a matter of law. A suggestive mark would be like Netflix, something that cleverly suggests what they sell, streaming online movies, without expressly saying what they sell, which is what respondent's mark does.
You turn to your lost profits argument. I can borrow a background. I think about lost profits proved up in business tort, other kinds of business tort cases, and it seems a little different. So the respondent's position is that, look, it just had to prove revenue, you know, it's attributable to the infringements, and then it shifted to your client to prove, no, that's attributable to other factors. And that is, in fact, what the jury instruction said, and I didn't object to that jury instruction. So how do we get around that to say that he's lost this $50,000 in lost profits is speculative?
Your Honor, the key part of what you just said is you have to show that the losses or lost profits are attributable to the infringing.
Your client's responsibility.
No, no, Your Honor. Once they have to first show that that we had revenues that were attributable to the infringement, causation, in other words. And then we would have the obligation of showing that, no, with expenses and stuff, the profit would be much less than that. The problem is they never made any connection. All they did was say, here's the revenues. And there was not a showing of a single sale, not one sale that went to my client that was supposed to go to their client because someone was confused. There was not a single speck of evidence regarding that. So how can there be lost profits when there's no showing that any infringing activity by my client caused any lost profit? So they're correct that if they show that, hey, we lost 14 sales and that's, you know, the revenues on that are, you know, $500,000, then yes, the burden would shift to us to then say it's less than that.
So I thought it was they had to prove the revenue, and then it was up to you to show the portion was attributable to other factors. Is that, and you're just saying they didn't prove the revenue?
They have to prove that, Your Honor, that the revenue has some relation to the infringement. I mean, we sell all sorts of things that we don't even compete with respondent in most of our business. So they have to show that there's some connection between the infringing activity and the loss.
And that's kind of this ice ring accessories, right, as I understand it.
Right, and so you can't just come in and say, well, your revenues were X, and then make no attempt to say, And these revenues would not have come in but for your infringing conduct. Once they make the connection between the revenues and the infringing conduct, yes, then we have the burden of showing that it's expenses and whatnot. Just to finish up on the legal protectability, because I do think it's quite clear here, is the suggestiveness issue is properly decided by this court as a matter of law. And I think the trial court gave this court a clear path to do that because it decided it for the first time as a matter of law post-trial. And it relied on the word all-American as being suggestive, but there's no authority whatsoever for the idea that merely putting tacking on a word to a descriptive mark makes it suggestive. It has to require some sort of imaginative or cleverness in order to support it. I see I'm almost out of time here. I do want to quickly address the confusion issue because I think the Minneapolis case, I think this case is kind of unique, and there are two Supreme Court seminal trademark cases, and there's very few trademark cases in state court. And there's a case where there was a trial, and the court reversed as a matter of law on the confusion issue in a case where there was actually stronger evidence of actual confusion in that case. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. You only have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Tim Mattson for the respondent, American Arena, All American Arena. See, you know, even I'm confused. Let me just touch the lost profit real quick, just because it was raised. So I think there was a confusion between profit, which is the appellant's profit, and actual damage, which includes lost sales of my client, but a number of other things. And on their profit, on the appellant's profit, there was clear evidence that they had made $15,414 from selling arena products under the mark American Arena. And under the American Honda Motor Corp case and the Lanham Act, our burden is simply to show what profit they made, and we did that. And then the burden shifts to the appellant to prove deductible expenses or factors attributable to things other than the infringement. So that is their burden. We show profit, their profit, and they have to show deductible expenses and things unrelated to the infringement.
And if they fail to do so, which I think in your argument.
Correct, they offered no evidence.
So open. So you're suggesting that any speculation that the jury may have had to do to reach their $50,000 number is kind of on the appellant?
Correct. And in fact, this jury could have found $615,000 as their profit attributable to the infringement. It only found 50, which, you know, and I know they complain about the percentages, but I think the district court was saying it was a minuscule amount compared to what they made. So let me turn back now
to the actual damages. That I also have concerns about that, right? That it seems the jury, and that you did have the burden of your proving your actual damages. And what did the jury have to look at to reach the number that it did?
Sure, 1 second. So the jury is asked to consider, and this was in the jury instructions, injury to my client's reputation, loss of goodwill, general business reputation, lost profits that my client would have made, advertising costs, and any other factor that bears on the damage to my client. Okay, and so we had evidence of a lost sale to Mason City. We had evidence of advertising.
What
revenue.
Was that lost sale worth? What was the evidence that of the monetary value?
We don't know because they never hired us to do what we were pitching. And so.
So did you put before the jury the amount you pitched and what you would have made?
We did not. We did not. But then there's advertising expenditures. I mean, we proved up $35,000 a year in advertising expenditures.
You ask for, I think it was, we were for at least 3 years. And it's just, so 3 years of advertising at $30,000, that's $90,000. I'm just trying to figure out the gap here.
Sure. And then there's damage to reputation. All the confusion that was created in the market, that's a factor that the jury can consider. There's the intent of the appellant in choosing a name similar to a company the owner had worked for. And so on damages, the law is clear that it doesn't have to be totally precise, okay? And it you give factors to the jury, you present evidence that our company is now a $10 million a year company, that brand has been damaged, and the jury is entitled to make that award. And again, the court, and it wasn't saying, you know, percentage is the analysis, but it said that the jury award was 8% of our revenue, not a big number for you know, the damage that it could have caused.
So, Mr. Benson, what was your best evidence that you presented to the jury about injury to your reputation? Because I mean, see that as, okay, we've got some on advertising that seems logical is the next step. What's your best
evidence? So we had many consumers testify as to our reputation in the industry and the problems created by the confusion in the marketplace. That testimony was directly relevant to what our reputation, you know, the damage to our reputation, that it did cause confusion, that people were going elsewhere. Now, I will say in trademark cases, actual confusion is not required to prove likelihood of confusion, but it is potent evidence of confusion. And McCarthy has even stated that it's really difficult to get consumers to testify that there was confusion. In this case, the evidence of confusion was overwhelming and uncontroverted. And the concept that
And that really was because in the first instance, the email just had the name,
correct,
American Arena, didn't have the logo, which
correct
is clearly different than the logo
sure
All American.
Sure, but the law is clear that when you look at a trademark, it's not the logo. You don't search a logo on Google. You search American Arena or All American Arena, and that directs you to the site, and there's Eighth Circuit authority.
But the particular confusion really came from those early emails with it.
Correct.
I mean, that's when you got the phone call saying, is this you guys or is this somebody else?
Yeah, but even if the logos were entirely different, it doesn't matter. The words are paramount in trademark. A logo is secondary and, in fact, wasn't present when all the confusion was created.
Well, let me understand, I think. It's clear that when you get when you register your mark with Minnesota, then under the statute, you are entitled to protect it. But there still is the issue of whether, in fact, just because you registered it doesn't mean it's a protectable mark.
You are entitled to the presumption
right
of ownership and the right to exclusively use.
And why didn't the defendant's request for a jury instruction on the descriptiveness defense, why was that not an appropriate instruction, and the denial of which really did prejudice the defense, right?
So the defendant didn't request an instruction on the descriptiveness of the respondent's mark. What they said was, and here's the instruction, number 7. This case also involves a contention by American Arena LLC that its use of the phrase American Arena in connection with its arena goods and services is descriptive of these goods and services. And that is classic fair use. Even though they don't say it, their argument was, listen, I can use the words American Arena because they are descriptive of the products. And I would say, you know what? They certainly could if they said, you know, McDevitt Ice serving American Arenas. They could do that because that's a factual statement.
I think it went farther, though. I mean, I'm just looking, you know, from the... And I know this was raised on the record and not in a written instruction. That might be the critical thing to you. But, I mean, American Arena asked for mention of the descriptiveness defense in the effect that if the mark is descriptive of all Americans' goods or services, the jury should find it's not a case of infringement.
They did not ask for that instruction.
Well, aren't they asking for it right there on the record? This is out of the charge conference before the jury, as I understand.
I'm not aware of that argument. Their argument throughout the whole case has been, our mark is descriptive, we can use it. Okay. And the law on classic fair use is clear. If you use it as a trademark, big letters, American Arena, then it is not a classic fair use. You're not using the descriptive terms. Like I said, they could say, we sell products to the American Arenas. They could have done that and we would have had no right to object. Instead, they put American Arena in their domain name, their website, their email. That was their company name. And in fact, announced the reason we're changing the name is because we're selling products we never sold before, but happen to be directly competitive with All American Arena products.
So, Mr. Mattson, if I may, I mean, assuming for this question that I agree with you that they, you know, did not make the appropriate objections on descriptiveness. You know, we do have case law that say, you know, that permit us to, if someone raises an issue post-trial, even where they didn't make the objection or on the jury instruction issue, that we can look at that. And, you know, but it's a relatively high standard, right? It's got if the error in jury instructions destroys the substantial correctness of the charge, it's a miscarriage of justice, things like that. But given the case, I remember the imported auto that case.
Yeah.
Why couldn't we look at that and say, look, this is so close to that case that we ought to say, there could be a substantial correctness of the charge as a whole is the risk.
Okay.
There's manifest injustice here. Because that, to me, is the hard question in this case.
Right. So imported auto parts, clearly distinguishable. That, in fact, was found by the Minnesota Supreme Court to be generic. Generic marks can never have any protection. Descriptive marks could, if you have secondary meaning. But then we have two cases.
So if they had asked for the right jury instruction, then you would have asked for the secondary meaning jury instruction?
No, no. I would have argued it's not descriptive as a matter of law. And the cases which we cite, Wilco and Crockett, are directly on point. The Wilco case said the words All American acquired, especially as used in connection with sport, a desirable connotation. And they go on to say, the court goes on to say, clearly, to have been intended as a distinctive name identifying defendant's products rather than merely a legend descriptive of the nature of the product. And same with Jim Crockett Promotions, the Great American Bash. And so what the courts were saying is, if you add something to the word American, you can take it out of the realm of a descriptive, primarily geographically descriptive mark, into a suggestive mark. Suggestive marks are always inherently distinctive under the U.S. Supreme Court decision in two pesos, that you do not have to show secondary meaning. And so it would have made no sense for me to argue secondary meaning because it doesn't apply. And more importantly, they never raised the issue or claimed that they needed a secondary meaning defense or instruction to the jury to find inherent distinctiveness. Their whole focus was on their mark, it's descriptive, therefore, we can use it. They never said your mark is descriptive, and therefore, you must prove secondary meaning. But even to that point, if you look at the record, if it troubles you that there is secondary meaning, that should have been an instruction, which we say clearly not, look at the evidence. We had 9 witnesses testify about the reputation and standing of my client in the industry. So even though it's not a relevant issue for trial, there was secondary meaning clearly established.
I wonder if you could, in your remaining time, briefly address the injunction. I guess my question is this: how can this court effectively review the injunction decision when the district court really provided no facts or analysis as to scope?
So the court order that, you know, there was an initial ruling of an injunction followed by an oral ruling followed by a written ruling based on the evidence. And then in the final order for judgment, the court laid out all the reasons. And part of that is intent. Part of it is confusion in the marketplace. And it is almost axiomatic that if a jury finds likelihood of confusion, finds trademark infringement, that you absolutely have to have an injunction. That just comes as a matter of course. One of the arguments or the complaints is that, oh, this is a state trial judge and it's under state law. How can it be worldwide or nationwide? Unlike copyright and patent, trademark cases have concurrent jurisdiction with state and federal courts. State courts can decide federal issues. And so in many cases, you will have both state law claims and federal claims. We have federal unfair competition claims in this case. And therefore, this court, the district court, had full authority to enter an injunction because of their intentional infringement, which the jury found. And again, it just goes as a matter of course. There's no, I don't think you have to have anything else other than the finding of intentional infringement for an injunction to issue. I'm going to just touch briefly on the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Mr. Hickey mentioned an email that was properly thrown out. It was not a final ruling of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And more importantly, the appellant applied for a wordmark, American Arena, did not disclaim those words. And so their application actually said to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, we can own these words. They later disclaimed it, but they took that position at the beginning. If the court has any other questions.
It appears not. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Hickey, you will have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me start with what Mr. Mattson said at the end. We did not have a registration for any wordmark. It's the logo. We've never made a wordmark. And so it's the words are included in that logo, and the USPTO has already found that that's a distinctive logo and that there are no conflicting logos that are out there. They haven't made the final registration decision. So really there was no need to even disclaim those because we weren't claiming the right to use the words American Arena all by themselves, a standalone wordmark. It was only as part of this distinctive logo. So that simply is not the case. The USPTO's email, as we cited in our reply, the USPTO can make determinations informally by email, even over the phone. Their rules and regulations specifically provide for that. And here, the examining attorney made the clear finding that American Arena is not protectable, their descriptive terms, and the jury was not allowed to hear that evidence. The fact that it wasn't final, I mean, it was a finding by the USPTO, the federal agency that's charged with actually deciding whether marks and words are protectable. Could we have appealed that for some reason? Yes, I suppose we could have. But the final, whether it's final, we're not claiming collateral estoppel. We're just claiming that this was highly relevant evidence that the jury should have been allowed to hear when the whole issue here is whether we can be prevented from using the words American Arena. On the imported autos case, counsel said that was clearly distinguishable, and I only heard one distinction, and it actually cuts our way. Counsel said, well, they actually found that the mark was generic. Well, that's even a lower standard than our mark, and the marks are very similar. We weren't even claiming that it was generic, but they're saying a very similar mark the Supreme Court found to be generic. Generic and descriptive marks are treated the same way unless they're secondary, meaning they're both non-protectable. So that's really a distinction without a difference. Plus, if you look at imported autos and the way the Supreme Court describes the mark, it says the name it has chosen for itself describes the nature of that business. That's exactly what we have here. So I do think that case is on all fours, and it supports invalidating that state registration when it comes to enforcing it against other people. Again, it doesn't mean that if someone used those exact words that they have on the state register, that they can't prevent them from doing that. But to say that we own two words of our mark and we can monopolize those words and prevent anyone else from ever using those, especially in the hockey arena industry, is the unprecedented. It really is. There's no support for that type of holding. The couple of dated cases that they cite dealing with American or All American, those involved federally registered incontestable marks. That was a fundamental problem with this trial. When you look at it and you read through the transcript, having not been there, is the trial court treated the state registration, where you submit an application and $50 and you get the registration, as long as no one else is using that exact name, like it was a federally registered trademark, in which they spend 12 to 18 months examining the mark.
Mr. Hickey, and that was why I asked you about the preliminary instruction. I think your client didn't object. How do we, getting back to my question to Mr. Mattson, you know, how do you demonstrate that there's a kind of a miscarriage of justice here that would lead us to say we're going to overlook that and address that issue on appeal?
Your Honor, there's nothing wrong with saying in the preliminary instruction that there's a presumption that it can be enforceable. The problem is it's not an irrebuttable presumption. We're allowed to say that it's descriptive, and we were not allowed to do that.
Thereafter, when the owner brings an action for infringement, the owner may rely solely on the registration certificate?
Yeah. Your Honor,
presumption.
I don't read that as saying we can't raise any defenses. That would have been a summary judgment, and the court denied summary judgment in this case.
Perhaps, if I may, just get to my second part of my question, which is really a more important one, is, you know, if we find that your client did not object, you know, or should have asked for a jury instruction when he didn't object to the jury instructions properly, what should make us think, and this is so wrong that we need to address this on appeal despite the failure to object?
Because this mark is not protectable as a matter of law. And the court found that post-trial, regardless of what the jury decided, the court found post-trial on a separate issue that the jury never considered, suggestiveness. And I think on that issue, you could decide this as a matter of law, that the court was in error in making that legal determination post-trial. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.
Thank you.